talk here, and this is the last stretch of the workshop, which means that we are almost in the limitation of our attention span. Okay, so I would, if I would try to try my best to make my talk under time instead of over time. Okay, so I limit myself to 30 slides and not too many words per slide. And I'm also taking the advantage of the fact that so many concepts and terms have been talked about, defined, and elaborated on in so many talks. Your house talk, Christian talk this morning, and Wayne's talk yesterday, and so on. The topic is about discrete logarithm problem. And remind ourselves what this problem is, and set up some notation. So we begin with a finite abelian group. We have an element x in A, and y, another element. Suppose that it's in the subgroup generated by x. So the problem is to compute a positive integer n so that y can be expressed as the n-fold group operation on x. And so in this talk, I write it additively because somehow we are more concerned about the elliptic curve version of this problem. So as you know, that in crypto application, we often assume that x is an element of large prime order. And for this talk, this large prime is going to be L. But the finite field that we're going to talk about is always FP. So primary examples of this finite abelian groups are the so-called multiplicative case. We're interested in the multiplicative group of a finite field FQ, and the so-called elliptic curve case, we're interested in the FQ rational point of an elliptic curve. And so discrete log, as you know, is the basis of many public crypto systems, including things like DSA, digital signature algorithms, or ECC, elliptic curve cryptography. Okay, so these two cases, on the multiplicative case, we have a fairly good algorithm based on some index calculus method, and the method runs in sub-exponential time. So the most sort of classical version of this method works as follows. We lift from the multiplicative group FP star to z, to integers, or more generally to the ring of integer or a global field. And in this case, lifting, so we lift the problem from finite field to a global field. And in this case, lifting is very natural and easy in some sense. So for example, A as an element in FP star can be lifted to A as an integer. But for the other case, for the elliptic curve case, ECDLP case, well, it may be natural to consider lifting from E bar of FP to some E of K, the model of A group, of some elliptic curve defined over some number field or some global field. And such that, of course, it needs to be a lift of the curve E bar, so that means E mod prime P is E bar. But in this case, lifting point is not quite as easy. It has been suggested that the high function on this elliptic curve plays a role and form kind of a barrier for a successful attack like index calculus, discrete logarithm problem. And so in this talk, what I would like to do is to examine this issue in light of some recent developments. And the second half of the talk is largely joint work with Wayne Raskin, and it's in some sense a continuation of second half of Wayne's talk. So, a bit more explanation about this index calculus attack. So we like to compute, we're given an element A in FP star, and we assume that we're also given a generator G for the group. We'd like to compute E such that A is common to G to the E mod P. But in fact, let's say L is the prime part of the of this group. So in fact, we might as well be content with just computing E mod L. And so to do that, we're going to pick a set of primes up to some smoothness bound, typically sub-exponential in log P. And this is usually called a factor base. And then we lift a random G to the R as an element in the group FP star to G to the R mod P as an integer. And we hope that it is smooth over S. Okay, so, but really what's happening here is that we are lifting this element to the group of S units in Z modulo L power. And we're not concerned about L power because in the end what we likely get is the index or discrete logarithm of A modulo L. Okay, so what happens is if we are able to lift number of S many random elements successfully, then this whole group which is of FL rank S will be covered, and then we can compute the discrete log of a basis for this group, and then we just need one more random lift to calculate the discrete logarithm for A through linear dependency. So that's the basic idea of this index calculus. So again, we need at least or about number of S plus one mini lifts. So the number one, the discrete log of a basis, can be determined, and number two, then an actual lift could yield the discrete logarithm of A through linear dependency. We could try a similar strategy for the D curve case, presumably. So we're trying to solve T equal M times S in E bar of FP. And the following description basically works for either so-called index calculus attack on elliptic curve or the Zenit attack of Joel Silverman. So we could lift, again, random multiples of S to points on the model of A group of elliptic curve E. And then we do another lift, say T plus BS, to a rational point Q. Now suppose these points become dependent on E of K, and let's suppose that P1 through PR generate E of K modulo L, and we assume that E of K is of rank R. And then this other point Q therefore must be linearly dependent on the first R points in this E of K mod L group or vector space. And so we're going to get a linear relation Q. We can express Q as a linear combination of the PI. And then upon reduction mod P, this is going to yield the discrete logarithm for T by simple linear algebra. Okay, so again, for this kind of methods to work, we need to lift so many random points from the downstairs group to the upstairs group, where the lifts are dependent upstairs. And that is so that once we have the dependency, then comes out of the other end of the computation will be the desired discrete logarithm. Okay, so. So none of this discussion. So if we want to ask ourselves, whether a lifting kind of attack would work, one problem that we are interested in, therefore, is to lift random points from the downstairs group to an upstairs group so that they become linearly dependent on the upstairs group. So that's the problem. Okay, so at this point, let me recall the so-called canonical height on the elliptic curve defined over a number field. And let's not worry about what the canonical high actually is, but suffice to say that this canonical high defined is a quadratic form and it defines a metric E of k tends to q, and therefore we can therefore visualize E of k as a lattice being embedded in an r-dimensional vector space, which precisely is E of k module all the torsion. As when you take a torsion point, the Kermankov height will be zero. Okay, so and because E of k is now a lattice in Euclidean space, there's got to be there's a lower bound on the points in terms of canonical height, and then we can also use a sort of standard geometric argument to estimate the number of points, that we can have within a certain height bound. But I guess from a computational point of view, maybe one thing that is worth mentioning is that this canonical height is logarithmic in nature. So we like to it won't hurt if we think of it basically as the number of bits requires to write down a point. This is just like number of bits to write down an integer. Canonical height is a measure of the length, length of the point. Okay, so we have r plus one points living in the downstairs group, and we'd like to see if we can lift it to some upstairs group. Okay. And if that's the case, that is, we say that e bar lambda is a r plus one tuple, is lifted to e capital lambda if e bar is the reduction of e modulo prime, and alpha I, the points downstairs, are the reduction of mod p of the upstairs points for some prime. Okay, so that's what a lifting method would typically do, right? Lifting points from downstairs to upstairs. But remember, we also need that these upstairs points become dependent, and that's important for our method to work. Okay, so therefore, and another thing is that if it's going to work at all, the canonical height of those points better be bounded. So for example, if you're shooting for a sub-exponential algorithm, those points, the height of those points better be bounded sub-exponentially. Okay. And okay, so that leads us to the next thing. So we call that lambda a r plus one tuple is h good for a few k if those points, okay, the tuple can be lifted to some elliptic curve in such a way that the lifts have canonical height bounded by h. Okay. And also that the rank of the upstairs model of A group should be bounded by R. Okay, so this will guarantee that those points become dependent. Okay, so the problem now, one problem we can abstract from this discussion is that so if we have a cyclic subgroup of the downscale group, so for example, we're interested in the cyclic subgroup of E bar of FP of order L, right, generated by an element. Okay, and so we are interested in counting the number of h good r plus one tuples from G how many r plus one tuple can we lift it from the downstairs group to some upstairs group is the question. And turns out this number is not this is a serious typo. It's not too big actually. It's very small. Even if h is sub-exponential in log of p. In fact, if we let n of rh be the number of r plus one tuples from g that are h good, then the fraction of those tuples is bounded by this. Okay. It depends. If you ignore the first term, this is not important. If you ignore the log of the discriminant, then roughly speaking, it's h raised to the r squared power. And h is at most sub-exponential in log p. Okay. So for this, and n is about p. So you see, for this fraction to be, say, at least 1 over sub-exponential in log p, r actually needs to grow. R cannot be bounded by a constant. R has to grow at least as fast as log p to the 1/4. Okay. So in other words, if we want to play the game of lifting tuples to dependent points upstairs. Maybe if we are lifting two, and if we even allow ourselves to lift for every tuple, we allow ourselves to lift to a different elliptic curve even. Okay. But if we fix and k, if we fix a field, then this fraction is going to be too small. Okay, now the reason behind this is basically the following. So if E of k is of rank r, the number of points in E of k with canonical height bounded by h is bounded like this. So again, it's bounded as a function that looks something like h to the r. And also the constant that we're talking about here is independent of E. It's here. Assuming things like Lenz conjecture on the absolute low bound of canonical height on the curve. But if any r plus 1 point of E of k of height bounded by h, as a result, must have a z linear relation with small coefficients. Okay, so if you're lifting points upstairs, their heights are bounded, they are dependent, and we find out that they have small relation, right? That's going to mean that we won't be able to lift too many tuples. Because the number of points upstairs that we can lift to, the target point, potential target point, is too small. So that is fundamentally the reason why the fraction is so small. So let's review the situation. Okay, so it appears that in practice, in computational terms, lifting to a given model of A group is quite difficult. If we specify an elliptic curve, to generate a non-trivial, a non-quotient is even not so easy, right? So that's not easy. But that alone doesn't explain the difficulty of lifting attack, because if our goal is to lift to some elliptic curve, then that's not so difficult, right? If we don't pin down the target elliptic curve, then lifting is actually not difficult if our goal is to lift one point, for example. Okay. But what we have said so far, in the previous slide, is that if given a number field, a target field, if we like to lift points to some, again, we don't limit ourselves to the target elliptic curve. If the goal is to lift to dependent points, then it's next to impossible unless the rank of the elliptic curve is not bounded by a constant. And therefore, at this point, an interesting question is, to get out of this difficulty, looks like we simply have to relax the degree of k. We should allow the degree of k to grow. Okay, and I think in this slide, I think we can say that the method, Hickman-Pohn method discussed by Joe this morning, is a very intriguing example. Even though it fails, you see what happens there is that you lift your downstairs points to an upstairs elliptic curve. But look at the lifted points. They live in all sorts of different Hilbert class fields. Those are Hilbert class fields of different imaginary quadratic fields. Therefore, if you look at the composite of those Hilbert class fields, it's enormous, right? It's an enormous field. But you try to leverage the fact that you can nevertheless compute dependency as long as you can compute their canonical height. So that is actually quite a clever scheme. And also because the discriminants of the imaginary quadratic fields are multiplicatively dependent, it appears as if there is some hope that they will become dependent upstairs. Okay. But of course, it turns out not to be the case. And so there is this intuition that if you allow the field to grow, to be so big, Naturally, and if you have to lift random points, if you have to sample random points from the downstate group, then it looks like the natural inclination is for the lifts to be independent rather than dependent. So I suspect that even if you allow the degree of K to grow, we won't find any kind of success. But it would be nice if we can either find a positive or a negative evidence along this direction. Okay, so I think we have to understand something about the difficulty of solving the elliptical discrete logarithm problem in terms of the, and we appreciate that high does seem like a barrier for attempting this problem. And therefore therefore what we should do is perhaps try to avoid taking on this problem directly. So in other words, we should try to get around this difficulty of lifting. So it is in this sense that global method can provide or has some hope of providing a way of escape, a way of getting around this problem. Okay, and this method was originally proposed by Fry. And methods of, and as Wayne pointed out, methods of this type have been considered also by Moon and a few other people. The basic idea is to address the discrete log problem by lifting to a number field again. But instead of trying to lift points to dependency, we try to do a more natural, simple-minded lifting by instead leveraging global duality or reciprocity law to transform the problem, to change the problem into some other problems that hopefully can be tackled more successfully. Okay, so the problem we're going to end up with, using the kind of global approach studied by Wen and myself, is something we call signature computation problem. Okay, so to explain how duality is can be used to kind of to get around this difficulty, let me very briefly review reciprocity law for the multiplicative group. And this I've been talked about so many times. So basically, we have in the multiplicative case for number fields, we have a pairing between Dirichlet characters and field elements. And so for Dirichlet character pi of k and any field element a, the sum of the local pairing is zero. And this is one form of reciprocity law. And again, let's remind ourselves that this is actually a finite sum. For elliptic curve, we have a similar pairing between the principal homogeneous spaces. We take a principal homogeneous space. And a point on the elliptic curve, we have similarly pairing. And the sum of local pairing is zero. And this is, again, a finite sum. So the idea now is to construct a suitable test element. So this would be a Dirichlet character in the multiplicative case, or principal homogeneous space in the elliptic case. And this element can be paired with a point of the group to give equation. But we really need this testing element to have ramification at a place over P, because that's the most interesting place. That's where the discrete log relation is going to be preserved. And then we need to control ramification in other places. Okay, so because of that, we therefore need a more refined version of this reciprocity law duality. And so, as Wayne explained in his talk, so we look for, we consider exact sequences from duality. So typically, we're going to take a set of places. And typically, S will contain P, some primes over P, and then places over L. Let G of S be the Galois group of maximal extension of K that is unramified outside of S. Mu L be the roots of unity, L through infinity, and in the next few slides, A star will typically denote the quadratic dual of A. Okay, so in the Monte Picker case, the sequence that's going to play an important role is a subsequence derived from a sort of about two Tate exact sequence. And so the kind of dual character we're interested in is representing the first term. Yeah. And the subscript S control the ramification. Okay, so and I think as you might have heard from Wayne's talk, that in order to show that there's something interesting in here, it turns out we need actually to look at the dual of the sequence. But anyhow, the thing that I want to point out on this slide though is that this is the group of Dirichlet characters that we're interested in, but in order to find, to prove that there's something interesting, there's a non-trivial Dirichlet character of the kind we actually end up looking at this sequence and show that the dual of the group is non-trivial. So for that, we show the dimension, FL dimension of the middle group is bigger than the FL dimension of the first group, and this is not difficult to do, and also use the fact that the second map is surjective under the assumption that L doesn't divide the class group. Okay, now one more thing I'd like to point out is that if you look at the first group, this is actually the S units group, modulo L power. Right. And so that looks familiar, right? Just a few slides ago. This is exactly the vector space that we lift our problem to. So in the case of possible index calculus, right, we O sub S is the S units, S integers, the S units of the ring of rational integers. Okay, so essentially what happens here is that if you look at the first map, okay, it really is index calculus. If you let S be a vector base together with prime P and L. So, right, so index calculus is interesting, mathematically speaking, because it computes the image, computes the first map. And what this kind of duality, exact sequence is going to do for us is that as we lift the problem from downstairs to here, using this duality, we can, so to speak, shift the problem to the other side. So that's the basic idea. For the elliptic curve situation, we have the Castle Tate exact sequence. And we need to, maybe I should skip this slide and just come quickly to the point. So from the Castle Tate sequence, we can derive this sequence that's going to play an important role for us. And here, E actually stands for a smooth problem model over the spec of OS. So in this sequence, so again, our job is first of all to prove that there's something interesting going on here after choosing a suitable S. Okay. And then again, we notice that the problem, the elliptic curve discrete log problem, is actually lifted to this group, or the spec FL, F vector space. And the first map, computing the first map, essentially boils down to discrete log computation. And that's hard. Okay. And it's particularly hard if you try to solve the problem using any kind of lifting tree. So instead, perhaps we can shift the problem, so to speak, to the other side. Okay. And so what we end up with is the following strategy. Right? So we find a suitable testing element here and here. I think this slide kind of repeat what I said earlier on. That is the strategy of finding something interesting here. But so, Yeah, so back up a little bit. So to show that we have a interesting testing element, a Dirichlet character in a multiplicative case, or a principal homogeneous space with prescribed ramification in the elliptic curve case. Again, what we do is we analyze the sequence, we analyze the dimension of the first and the second term, using the fact that the last, the second map is a surjective map. So all we have to do is to show that the dimension of the middle is greater than the dimension of the first. Okay. So in this way, we demonstrate the existence of an interesting test order. And we do need some mild conditions on the field K. Okay. So in the multiplicative case, we consider the real quadratic field. And S consists of one place over P and one place over L. And the mild condition we need is that the class number is not divisible by L. And basically, we also need that the fundamental unit is not an L power locally at P and at L. With that, we can show that the FL dimension of the character that we're interested in is exactly one. And you have a similar situation for elliptic curve. And so there, one of the assumptions we have to make is that the Schwarzschild group is not only finite, but the L part is trivial. And since L is a big prime, I think intuitively we feel like it's okay to assume that. And again, with those conditions in place, we can show that the FL dimension of the principal homogeneous space is of the FL dimension of the test of principal homogeneous space is exactly one. And moreover, this non-trivial element, this principal homogeneous space, will be ramified at P, and that's the most important thing for us. Okay, so once we get hold of this interesting test element, we actually want to kind of turn the sequence around and look at their dual. Okay. And so then the testing elements are sitting right in here. And the first map, okay, so then what this duality is going to tell us essentially is that the second map, and if you look at the dual of the second map, that boils down to discrete logarithm. And by virtue of this duality, that problem can be turned into the problem of computing the image of the first map. And I'll explain a little bit more about that. And so that leads us to define the signature calculus as essentially the problem of computing this first map, the image of the first map. And in our situation, this is essentially a character or principal homogeneous space, right, up to scale. Okay, so we're just asking the question, what is the image of this global Dirichlet character? What does it look like locally? And this principal homogeneous space, right, what does it look like locally? And at this point, see, the interesting thing is on this side of the sequence, we have something that looks like a more natural number theoretic question. And we can apply this strategy and to essentially look at the class square index calculus and understand a little bit more what is actually taking place. So the dual of this map, okay, is from the group of S units mod L's power into the local situation, local field mod the group of non-zero elements mod L's power. And in fact, this is to compute the image of an element here is exactly what the index calculus would do for us. Okay. So for example, if you take G to the A mod P, lift it here, okay, then its image at P will be nothing but this exponent A. And if, and as you factor it over X, so let's say 3 divide G to the A mod P. This, I mean, let's say 3 squared divide G to the A mod P. Then the image of G to the A mod P at 3, at the component corresponding to 3, will be essentially 2, the variation. And so this is essentially smooth factorization. Okay, so the reason why index calculus works is because, number one, there's no difficulty in this lifting. That is to say, when we enlarge S, lifting becomes easier and easier. And when S becomes sub-exponentially large, we have one of the sub-exponential chains of success. And actually, because lifting is not a problem, so there's also not a problem to do one more lift. So in that situation, we don't need the other side to help us. We can solve the problem directly on this side of the diagram. Though we can say that since we can compute the dual of this image, I mean the image of the dual of this map, we can actually compute the signature of the character in this group. In this case, it also happens that this is a group of FL dimension 1. And in fact, it's generated by a Dirichlet character ramifying exactly at P. So I guess at this point, we can bring up this issue of feasibility of index calculus from the perspective of this global approach. So for the multiplicative case, once we fix a field, index calculus essentially lift from GM of FP, which is FP star, to GM of OK, which is OK star. We can consider lifting from GM of FP to GM of OK, but that is difficult, right? Because then we're trying to lift things to the unit group. And in fact, if you try to do it this way, then you have very similar high problem, right? Yeah, if you try to lift to a unit group of a number field, the situation will be very similar to what happens in the elliptic curve case. But instead, we lift from GM of FP to the S units, namely to GM of OS, the ring of S integers, and that is the group of S units. And that becomes relatively easy when S contains enough of the small primes. And once we have enough lift that can generate the whole group in modulo L power, we can determine the signature and we can solve the discrete log problem. Okay. Now, if the analogous strategy for elliptic curve therefore should be lifting from script E of FP, which is E bar of FP, to script E of the ring of S integer, right? But what is that? Well, that turns out to be exactly the K model A group. And this is because of the, I think Wayne made this point in his talk, and this is because of the projective nature of the elliptic curve. So the difference between an affine object, affine group, and a group that is defined projectively, defined from a projective object, seem to make all the difference, at least in the sense that it just doesn't matter which S you pick, you end up in the same group. Okay, so therefore the set S of places doesn't make a difference. Well, not until we consider duality. So when we look at sequence like this, yeah. So, and in fact, that's why. Okay, so it doesn't make a difference. This is going to be E of K no matter what S you pick. But choosing a different S could potentially make a difference in terms of the problem on the other side, the signature problem. And so therefore we should consider what this issue from the point of view of period or duality. Right, so let's consider the elliptic curve case. Now, there we have this reciprocity law. We have pairing between a principal homogeneous space and a point. Now, but as you analyze it just a little bit, you realize that the finite places, the places V where this is going to be non-trivial, okay, can only come from a place V of a very large norm. So in fact, and this is due to the nature of the local pair or local tape duality. So at V, the pairing is between the local principal homogeneous space and E of KV mod L. This pairing is perfect, but if you analyze this a little bit, you see that it's going to be isomorphic to E bar of FV modulo L. And this is non-trivial only if L divides the number of points on E bar of FV, where FV denotes the relative positive at V. So that means unless the norm of V is divisible, is of the order L, at least, right? We are going to have only trivial contribution coming from V. So you can, the kind of places you can put in S that's going to be meaningful are places that are by nature very large already. Their norm is at least L. And so this is quite different from the situation situation for the multiplicative case. But this also suggests that the only places of interest in the elliptic curve case, if I'm going to play this total duality game, is places above P and places above L. So if we focus on that, what we end up with is this equivalence result. So on the multiplicative case, what you end up with is a polynomial time equivalence between the discrete logarithm problem and the problem of computing signature for real quadratic fields or Dirichlet characters of real quadratic field satisfying some mild condition. Those are conditions that appeared in the proposition a few slides before. In the elliptic curve case, you have very similar result, and that is the ECDO problem is random polynomial time equivalent to computing the signature of principal homogeneous spaces for quadratic fields. And this quadratic field they don't need to be real. They can be real or imaginary. And again, some mild assumptions, mild conditions need to be imposed. Okay, so, and so, what this theorem say is that now we have potentially a way to compare and contrast these two discrete logarithm problems, namely the multiplicative case and the elliptic curve case. Because if you look at the equivalent problem, the so-called signature computational problem, they look completely analogous. You have Dirichlet characters on one side, you have principal homogeneous spaces on the other side, and both are number theoretical problems. Okay, so in the next couple of slides, I'll explain the proof of this equivalence. I give a very broad outline of what happens here. So it really is a very natural consequence, as you can see what's going on here, okay, the duality that is taking place in this sequence. So and let me use the elliptic curve situation for illustration. So again, if you look at the second map, the dual of this map is essentially asking for a discrete logarithm at P. And of course, in S, you have places over L. But turns out, computing the image at those places are easy. Those are essentially discrete logarithm, but at L. And those are easy. And so the hotspot is the place of the key. And so essentially, this boils down to computing discrete log problem in log FP. Now, the signature problem is computing the image of the first map. Okay. And the way these two problems become equivalent is basically that the image of the first map, which is a signature problem, precisely annihilates the image of the second map. Okay, computing the second map is the index calculus problem under the under this sum of local pairing. Okay, so they sort of meet together in the middle, okay, and they annihilate each other linearly, okay, or in this sense, in the sense of sum of local pairing. And that's why if you can compute the image, if you can compute the image of one map, you can determine the image of the other map, and vice versa. Okay, if you want to see how this plays out in the case of the elliptic curve, let's say we want to reduce the ECDL to a signature. Okay. So you're given Q tilde, you want to compute the discrete log of R tilde in terms of Q tilde. So you do a natural lift, right, a random lift from Q to some E of Q. And then once you fix this E, it's very difficult to lift the second point to the same group, to Q again. But you can choose to lift R tilde to some random quadratic field and hope that the conditions in the propagation, those conditions are mild conditions and they're typically satisfied. And now you have this duality or reciprocity laws, right? Which says that the sum of the local pairing should be zero. So R is the lift of the point where you want to compute the discrete log. Okay, and it works out this way. N and M prime can be easily calculated, as I explained earlier. So those are so essentially discrete log at places over L. Those are easy. M is the discrete log at the place over P, and that's what we want to figure out, and that's hard. Okay. But what about these three pairing? Well, they essentially describe the image of chi, okay, in the map that we talked about. They essentially gives the image of chi in this map. If you have any other, if you have other sort of reasonable presentation of what you mean by the image, you end up with the same amount of information. And still come to solve the discrete log problem, as you notice that these things sum to zero. And so if you know the ratio between these three things, you know M prime and M, then M can be determined. Okay, so I come to the last slide. So we have this equivalence with signature problem. Okay, but I think we probably have succeeded in avoiding tackling the lifting problem head on, but we end up with a different problem, okay? A nice looking number theoretic problem, but this is where we find ourselves facing a new set of challenges, right? So let me explain these challenges. First of all, these test elements, we know they exist, we don't quite know how to construct them. In all cases, for the Monte Carlo case, the Monte Carlo case is easier to handle. Let me just put it this way. But the elliptic curve case, we have partial results. We only have partial results. How to explicitly construct this test element? So that's a nice open problem. These objects are not small objects. Right, so if you think of them as curves, they are defined over the same field K, but they are isomorphic to our curve, our elliptic curve, over a large, very large extension. And the degree of that extension has to be divisible by L. Right? So we're talking about huge object. Nevertheless, it would be interesting to try to understand principal homogeneous spaces with prescribed implication. Computationally and even theoretically, so that we can get a better handle on the problem. All that we are asking is what does it look like locally at these few places? Okay. But this problem looks to be very challenging. So that's the first one. And better still, can we work with this object, given that they are huge, can we work with them in such a way that we don't actually need to write them down? Okay. And so the situation is basically for every choice of a discriminant for a real quadratic field, say, or imaginary quadratic field, you have this essentially unique principal homogeneous space. Okay. And all of these homogeneous spaces embed into the same thing locally. Okay. And the question is, as D varies, how do the signature, how do the image vary? That's the problem. Okay. And can you figure this out without explicitly constructing those guys? That's the second challenge. And short of doing this, perhaps we can figure out special cases where the problem do become easy. Yeah. So I hope this is an enticement for more people to look into this problem and get interested in. And I think I end my talk 5 minutes under time.